Hey, Justin.
Yes, David.
I've come up with a way to save the TV industry.
And what is that?
A podcast all about TV shows and the people that make them happen.
Good. When are we going to start it?
10 seconds ago. This is TV Show and Tell. Hello and welcome to TV Show and Tell, your tour guide through the back streets of the television industry. I'm David Bodicombe, I'm a games consultant and entertainment producer from London.
And I'm Justin Scruggy, a TV content specialist known internationally as the Format Doctor.
And in today's show, our special guest is Fred Hammerland, who reveals some very interesting aspects to key art, those thumbnails and clickable images we see on streaming platforms. We'll also be discussing quizcoms and the changing nature of job roles in TV. But first, it's news time.
So, if you remember last autumn, there was a show on Channel 4 called Don't Look Down.
Yes.
If you saw that, where celebrities were facing their fears of heights, and they were training to walk across a high wire over 6 weeks, which went very well, I think, actually. I think the finale attracted 1.5 million viewers, which these days is a lot for Channel 4. So ITV have jumped on the Let's Frighten Celebrities bandwagon with a new entertainment and wildlife crossover format called Shark! Celebrity Infested Waters.
Okay.
So this is slated to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Jaws.
I also thought I could call it something like Don't Feed the Fish, but I guess that sounds more like a panel game.
Yeah, well, I think the Shark! Celebrity Infested Waters, the poster's very like Jaws and all the rest of it. Anyway, it's a fish out of water in the water with fish format. And yes, sharks are fish, which I'm sure you know.
Yes.
So basically, it's daring a group of ocean-phobic celebrities to confront their greatest fear, which in this case is sharks.
Sharks don't have any bones, so which one would be more spineless, the celebrities or the sharks?
Well, I'm sure they're... Yes, well, we'll find out who they are, I'm sure. Anyway, so they're flying them to the Bahamas, which apparently is the shark capital of the world, where they will be pushed past their limits and come nose to nose with nature's biggest villains.
They don't seem to use that as their tourist slogan. I don't know why. Bahamas, shark capital of the world.
So the makers say they'll also, I quote, come to appreciate sharks' valuable place on the food chain. I wouldn't mention the word food chain either, really. Recognizing that a world devoid of these notoriously terrifying creatures is downright frightening. So, yeah, there is quite a trend at the moment of, you know, how much can we scare celebrities? It's just a thing, you know. Right. But so, yeah, that's one show that's now been commissioned. So we shall look forward to that.
This is a quick one about talking about celebrities. They've announced who's going to be fronting, voiceovering, I suppose, our version of the Genius Game in the UK. It's going to be David Tennant.
So not Dara O'Brien. I thought Dara O'Brien was the go-to person for all things kind of brainy.
Brainy and mathsy, yes. Well no, David Tennant.
Well,
that's the reaction that's been. It's like everyone's sort of gone, oh, okay, that's good. But it's one of those things, isn't it? It's like it taps into a useful little trick that producers need to know about, which is, I think, using talent in a condensed way for maximum impact. I mean, you know all about this. So, but effectively, because the person in the Genius is, in most versions, just a loop of a person, just sort of like looking down on the celebrities with sort of hands folded under chin, all they are is effectively just a voiceover artist. In that sense, if they are using David Tennant in that way, he could just do a day or two maximum in the voiceover booth, and then his persona is across the entire series. It'd be interesting to see how much time they're going to get from him.
I think we must make mention of the jury murder trial on Channel 4, because this really has been a remarkable series. So for listeners who don't know it, this is a social experiment whereby a murder trial, a real murder trial, has been recreated word for word in a courtroom in front of a jury who have to decide whether they're guilty or not. What that jury doesn't know is there's a second identical jury in the room next to them who's doing exactly the same thing. And the purpose of the exercise is to find out to what extent outcomes of trials really do depend on who's in the jury, how they're feeling that day, what the mix of them is, and so on, as opposed to the kind of raw objective justice. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give the ending away, but I wanted to mention this. I know I've mentioned this before, I think, on this podcast, but so few things that are called social experiments actually are experiments. They're usually what would happen if. And one of the things I find joyful about this show, which was very, very compelling to watch, is that it is a proper experiment. They've set up a hypothesis, which is juries are heavily influential on outcomes. They've designed an experiment, a proper experiment to test it. They've got a method of doing that. They've got to control subjects. So they've got two sets of people to compare. They've got proper data that they can compare with, so they can come to a proper conclusion. And in the process, of course, they've created a debate that's gone nationwide.
Have they stacked one of these juries with hawks and one of them with doves to try and maximize the chances?
That they haven't done. They haven't done that. So what they've done is purely they've cast them separately. Because if we remember, we never get to see what happens in a jury room. You think you know what happens in a jury room, and then you realise actually you've only ever seen it in a movie or on TV, because jury rooms are not televised or recorded or anything. So actually, in theory, no one really knows what goes on in a jury room. So, you know, what you have is basically just two sets of ordinary people who take it remarkably seriously. I mean, that I was a little bit baffled by. You know, they're in tears and shouting at each other and sobbing about, you know, various victims, whether it was the perpetrator or the person who was killed and so on. I mean, their level of immersion was quite extraordinary, actually. Mm. Again, you know, we've worked on shows where you cast people who are very susceptible to being put into a context, into a fictional context, and they've obviously done that here. But the idea is that they are as, if you like, as random as a jury called to jury duty are. So there's no distinction between the two. They're just two different sets of people. And the question is, would two very different sets of people come to the same conclusion or different conclusions?
What I liked about it was this week I saw a publicity shot of it, of like the jury in the red lit room and the jury in the blue lit room. And you sort of go, if you can see a format in pictorial form and go, oh, either I know exactly what's going on there, or I'm at least intrigued by what that setup is, then it goes a long way to selling the format.
So right. I've said this so many times to people, is can I see the show in a single shot? And you're so right. It absolutely does. I mean, funnily enough, I realized as I talk about TV at home way, way too much, because my wife's first reaction was, but what about the eye line? It's like, really? This is what you've noticed about this show? Is, you know, if the two barristers, you know, when they're talking to the jury, which one are they talking to? And why is one jury thinking why they're talking to the wall over there? And the other thing that she was worrying about was people's glasses, because surely these two, you know, brightly lit, color-coded rooms, you know, are going to reflect on someone's glasses who's facing the jury and so on. And I thought, I'm just sitting here enjoying the show. You know, I'm getting all these technical questions from the left here. There are times when I get very fed up with Channel 4. Sometimes I feel its reputation for, you know, doing radical things is utterly, utterly belied by the acres and acres of bland property programming.
What do you mean? They just announced that they're going to do a Jamie Oliver air fryer series. That's edgy.
Well, I kind of rest my case. But, you know, and then they do these dog whistle things, which have ridiculous titles like, you know, raise your children like a dog and this kind of stuff. But on this occasion, I think they've done something very smart, very on message. It's sort of exactly what Channel 4 ought to be doing. And I really want to just give them credit for that.
Something that's developed into a new art form are the thumbnails and preview images that we see on YouTube, Netflix, and other new media platforms every day. But have you ever wondered about how they decide what to put in them? Our special guest this week is Fred Hammerland, an expert into what's known as key art. Let's hear from him now.
Our guest today is Fred Hammerland, who was until very, very recently the creative director at Viaplay EPK and key art production in Europe and the UK, where he oversaw more than 70 productions a year, including key art, we'll explain that in a minute, trailer production and creative strategy. His new venture is called Second Place Studio, which is a London agency specialising in creative strategy for film and television. They distill rich stories into impactful key art, catchy taglines and kick-ass trailers. I like that. Let's start with definitions. So first of all, welcome, Fred.
Thank you, Justin. Happy to be here. It's actually the first time I'm on a podcast. So
is it? Oh, great.
I'm losing my virginity, so to speak. And I have the two of you watching while I'm doing it, which is kind of weird. But I guess that's show business.
That's show business. Well, we have an intimacy coordinator standing by, so all is good. So let's start with definitions. I've used the word key art several times to describe what you do. What is key art?
Well, people use different terms, right? Some people call it a poster, others thumbnail. We call it key art at Viaplay. And key art is kind of a new term for posters. It's been around since the 70s, and it was coined by the Hollywood Reporter. And it's defined as a singular iconographic image that's the foundation upon which a movie marketing campaign is built. One key image.
Yeah.
And posters have been around forever, right? I mean, since the dawn of cinema. I mean, the first one I saw was a Lumiere right. Brothers film in the late 1800s. But key art is fairly new, 70s, and become more and more important these days because of streaming. And also because you have so many different media buy options. So you have all these different formats. So the need for a versatile design that can scale and adapt have become more and more important.
Right.
And that's your key art, one key image that you can scale then to put to banners, out of home advertisement, on your platforms, everywhere you can think of.
Okay, so you're actually not only talking about a single image, but one that may need to fit into a square frame as a thumbnail, and may need to fit into a letterbox as a banner, and so actually change shape as well as size.
Exactly. When we start out, we usually pitch in vertical format, sometimes in square, but you have to think about horizontal. And what works beautifully in a vertical framing might not work so well in a small banner on some website somewhere.
I saw one recently, which was the Road to the Million, where they had people crawling up a crane, but the bus was like along, but it also had a vertical bit as well. So it was like this weird T shape.
One of those cranes is a perfect T shape, isn't it?
Yeah. It actually, as an image, it worked very well, but it made me sort of laugh and think, wow, imagine having to devise something to fit that shape.
Yeah, there's agencies that dedicate just to formatting, which is kind of crazy. And the T shape that you think about is very London bus kind of vibe, or UK bus. It wouldn't exist in other countries per se. But I've seen some great examples of that, like you mentioned, and some terrible ones too. A lot of times you just end up filling it with like a color or a negative space because, okay, you have your talent and then you have a title and then maybe that's it.
Sometimes the bolts on the side of a London bus are also strategically placed so that they're allowed to show a nipple, for example, that they're not actually showing a nipple, it's actually the bolt from the bus.
I mean, that's really clever. Actually, when you say it now, I remember this. It was a poster for Legend. I mean, the Tom Hardy film about these gangsters. I forget their names now.
The Cray twins.
Yes. And they had a poster, a review poster, and they hid the only poor review between the heads. So it looks like it's four and fives all around, but it was two from Empire or someone between the heads. So you think it's another four, but no, it's a two.
That's so funny. So let's just talk about what's the main purpose of key art? What's it trying to do?
It tries to communicate the genre and the tone of that program as effectively as possible to an audience.
Okay.
And it has to be super, you know, clear what this is, because the average for an out-of-home advertisement is about 1.5 seconds of viewing. But when you're on a streaming platform, you're scrolling left to right, you barely spend more than a second per image, right?
Hmm.
The human brain can process images in as little as 13 milliseconds. So you have to be really clear on what you're trying to say. And if you don't look like an action film, the people who love action films are not going to click on that thumbnail.
Right.
And how does that communicate in terms of, do you deal with different genres? So like, how would a drama look different from a reality show, even though the emotions on screen might be relatively similar?
A lot has to do with genre conventions. I mean, you've seen enough dramas to know kind of what a poster looks like. And the same goes for reality. Well, actually, colors is probably the best example of it. It's way more saturated. You can look at conventions online, right? How does a drama poster look like? In reality, very bright colors. Usually someone's shirtless, smiling for sure. Drama, less smiling. You want to have potentially like a brownish colorscape, and then maybe a dark red title, something that says premium drama rather than B-movie. But there's so many conventions out there, so you have to kind of know them, and you can break them a little bit, but not too much, because then you lose your audience.
I remember you showing examples of a poster with a couple back-to-back with a white background. I think you showed us about 15 or 20 versions of that poster from different shows.
Example of rom-coms, usually. Male and female lead standing back-to-back looking at the camera, and you have them on a white backdrop, you know?
Hmm.
There's a lot of Christmas movies out there, and they all look exactly the same. It's all working with red and greens and a couple in a frame. And it's just, you can scroll, you say you have Netflix or whatever you have, you can scroll them indefinitely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about colors, because this is a good way into that topic. So the use of color obviously is critical. You've just described how, you know, a reality show would be saturated with color, but individual colors also convey things. They convey different emotions. So could you give us a sense of what that palette is?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you got to pick a color that works for your content, but also depending on how you're using advertisement, right? So if you're doing out of home, you want one that has high observation value. And that could be yellow or red. Both are prime colors. Red has the highest observation value in out-of-home, and that's because it's a signal color, you know, like a traffic light. Traffic lights having green, amber, and red.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hardwired as humans to keep an eye out for red lights, right, when we traffic. It means danger. So you also happen to spot the billboard when you drive by. And then when you pick these colors, you have to bear in mind what they mean, like you said, right? You have positive and negative emotions attached to a color. I mean, red signal love, passion, power, but also longing, aggression, and danger.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's some studies that have shown that being exposed to or wearing red can even elevate your blood pressure. So if you're creating a TV advert, you have to be really careful also, because red is so heavily linked to Netflix. They own red color. We used it a couple of times, but immediately people think, like, is that a Netflix show? Like, no, it's not. It's a Viaplay.
Right, right.
I think it's been proven that in the Olympics, the boxes wear blue and red, and there's a long-term trend of the red boxer winning maybe, let's say, 54% of the bouts.
That's interesting. I wonder if that's like referees view it differently.
And I think when the England cricket team redesigned their one-day shirts, rather than using blue or white, which is their traditional England colours, they chose ketchup red because the sports psychologist said that red is a winning colour.
That's very, very interesting. Speaking of football, I read about there's a shade of pink that some people, you know, paint the visitors' locker room because it pacifies their aggressiveness, you know.
Is that drunk tank pink?
It is indeed. Specific shade of pink, right? Painted in cells in prisoners, but also then utilized by football teams.
What are the positives and negatives of pink then, if it's got two different sides to it?
Depends on the shade, to be honest.
Okay.
Like any color, actually, it also the motif plays a part, right? So that's what puts the red towards either love or danger, right? What is your motif? And the same with most colors. So you can trick the brain that way, right? You're leaning towards one or the other. And I used to know all the colors. I'm kind of rusty on that front now, so you tend to do the research. I know that we're wearing black, right? And black is mystery and it's power and elegance, but also fear and depression, which kind of sums me up nicely and probably why I wear it, you know?
Well, because you're a mixture of the two.
Well, I mean, it's up to you to say. I'm not going to give which one away.
And yellow?
Yellow could be madness, but it could also be paradise. Hmm. I mean, we had an award-winning show called Partisan. We did a purely yellow campaign. It was based on this feeling of like heaven on earth. So you had a paradise, you had like yellow fields of flowers, right? And then sinister underbelly, things going wrong. And we did a campaign that was like teasing this with some character portraits, but also some like mutated frogs and yellow, hugely powerful out of home as well. But it's nice for us because it meant like you had a paradise, you had a hope. Mm. We also have the sinister kind of like unwell feeling of something is lurking under the surface. And with the twisted frogs, it totally worked. It's telling both things in the same image. And that's a really effective key art when you can say more than one thing, right? You might instantly understand something, but then you think about more like, actually, it could mean something else.
At the start, you touched on the fact that your work is seen on many different devices, and that can be quite a ludicrous range of things, because obviously on a mobile phone, if you're scrolling through things, your thumbnail might be a tiny portion of even a relatively small screen. Then going up to laptop computers, PCs, you might watch on a 4K television, and then you said, of course, on huge posters. How on earth can you design something that works basically on that vast range of different sizes of format?
I think it's helpful to think thumbnail and smallest format first and then scale upwards, because anyone can design like a massive billboard, but it's like you say, it's much harder for the small image on your platform, or even if you're looking on, you know, iPlayer on your phone, you need something tiny that also works.
Mm.
And that's where color comes into play, but also symbols. I mean, we've done some research that proved that they're more memorable than a title or an actor. Like, you might remember, like, or maybe you don't even know who Elijah Wood is, but an image of the ring will help you remember Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah.
You guys both worked on Crystal Maze, right? You have the crystal. That's a hugely effective symbol.
Hmm.
And that helps you, like, recognize it on small and on huge format. It's kind of like the goal now. The Holy Grail is find that graphic identity that can be scaled, you know?
Yeah.
Very effective in young adult segment, because then you can use it to play around with in custom emojis. You can print it on merchandise. You can have a backdrop on your event, you know, with all these symbols, whatever they may be. And I think that's really, really effective.
It's like the Minecraft effect. It's like that face of the creeper, which is basically what, something like about 12 squares that they've arranged to look like a basic face, that is now on every school child's backpack and ruler. And
exactly.
You just see it everywhere.
Great, yeah. Example. I mean, you know, sell some merchandise, build your brand, and you can do so by a symbol. Otherwise, just a title. I mean, there's a lot of programs out there, you know, and even if your title is very memorable, it's not enough these days.
What do you do when you have a show with a big cast? We have a number of shows, both reality shows and dramas, where it isn't an individual actor that's associated with it, but an ensemble cast. But obviously you can't fit all of those people into a tile. So what do you do then?
It's probably one of my least favorite projects for that reason. And it's like, I go to a lot of startup meetings, right? So it's just after green light, this is the show or film we're making. And then it'll mention the cast and you're taking notes, right? And you hear name after name after name that sells. These are PR worthy names. And then you go like, oh, F, I have to put them all in there somehow. And we hate that. Because there's not that many ways to do it. You can do floating heads, classic Hollywood cliche, right? Just 2, 3, 4 heads floating in the sky and then a scene underneath. Or you can, which I prefer, is when you take a scene from the script and you kind of tweak it to fit more people. It could be, say, in the lobby of a hotel or a restaurant table or anything with a lot of people in it. It will be a little bit staged because you want to see certain people more and am I looking at the camera, but at least it feels more genuine and more like a frame grab or a grab straight from the film rather than something constricted. And if it's reality, then it's okay if it's really constricted and directed, that's fine. But if it's high-end drama with all these famous people, you might want to feel like it's just like another grab from the film, you know?
That's interesting. And what about faces? I mean, faces are the things that fit the space the best, but there's quite a lot of psychology around the use of space, use of faces, I mean.
Yeah, use of space and use of face. Psychology around both.
Yeah.
But eye contact, that always works, right? And there's a reason why magazine covers have, you know, faces looking at you, because the human brain are just drawn to these faces. We've done some tests about, you know, you do mapping. Where's the heat map? Where are the eyes drawn to? And they're always drawn to the eyes first.
Mm.
And even if it's inanimate objects, we did a poster for a documentary where we had a stone bust. And these are not even lifelike eyes. It's just the shape of an eye. And when we tested it, attention immediately goes for those eye sockets. And then the title, because title has a bright color.
Mm.
But hugely effective. And that's why you see it so often on billboards, on magazine covers, face, and then looking at you.
We're going to look at a very popular genre now with the world of the quizcom, which is a term that we don't really use in the UK. So what is that, Justin?
Well, quizcom, I think, is the current term for comedy quizzes. So quiz comedy, just as sitcom is situation comedy, quizcom is quiz comedy, or comedy quiz. So it's what we would call in the UK panel games.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the BBC are currently looking for quizcom formats to take down under. So they're looking for something that would work in Australia for some strange reason.
There's even a slight split between panel games and comedy panel games. You could even argue that things like Call My Bluff, the dictionary guessing game, is a classic panel game, whereas I'd say comedy panel games are ones that are completely played for laughs and it doesn't matter what the points are, whereas panel games, it slightly matters.
Yes, it's a funny thing. You're absolutely right. I mean, some of the line between those two are very blurred. I mean, 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown is literally a cross between two types of quizcom, exactly along the lines that you say. And again, comedy panel games, I don't know how many panel games there are left these days that don't involve, you know, celebrities or comedians or whatever. I think what's interesting with the particular call from the BBC is that, generally speaking, panel games don't export all that well. I mean, they export as finished programs and people use them very much as an example of, you know, British humour at its best. But as a format, generally speaking, it's quite a British thing.
Mm.
So whenever I've heard of a show that, you know, started off, you know, as a very clever quiz and has ended up as a comedy panel game, and you and I both know one that did that in the evolution of being worn down like a pebble over about 5 years of development. The trouble is that what you get at the end is something that may work very well in the UK, but is not very exportable. It's not going to make money for the people who created it because it's been put into a form that doesn't really work in other places. The places it does work a bit, curiously, are former colonies of the British Empire. So you do see the odd panel game in Canada. You do see some in South Africa, and you do see some in Australia. I think those are more a legacy of having had our TV in the early days of their TV, that a lot of the content they got was from the UK, and therefore they were growing up with British television more than, say, America or Europe or whatever.
I think there's two routes to the panel game, which are, first of all, the stalwart that is BBC Radio 4, which has had panel games since the dot.
Yes.
And we've had a long and varied history of quizzes on all sorts of topics and in all sorts of formats, in all sorts of styles. But they have been a constant thread on Radio 4. And also, I think partly the quiz show scandals, when they happened, producers had to come up with something else. And so they sort of went, well, we can't give away prizes because people suspect that we're rigging everything. So they went back to, or they devised new panel games of a sort. So things like What's My Line, for instance, was seen as it's a wholesome evergreen format that's just a bit of fun.
One of the things I find interesting about a lot of panel games is that they start a lot more complicated than they end up. So if you go back to the first episode of Would I Lie for You, for example, the current whole show was basically one round. And there were various, there were then other rounds to it. And it's true of a number of the panel games that have just gone on and on and on forever. People like Talkback and so on are ruthless with the comedy. And if something works and it's the one that gets the laughs, then that's what they do. And so gradually the other stuff gets stripped away and you come up with one formula that works. And then you just repeat that game over and over. Whose line is it anyway? Because to memory, that was the first game that I remember where the points really didn't matter and didn't make any sense whatsoever. That felt like that was the point where the game and the comedy started to get detached from one another in quite a major way. I mean, there are some times when the games gets too lost. But I think Would I Lie to You, is a show that's actually just matured and matured and matured. I mean, the last series that's been on has been absolutely brilliant. And they're very brave in the casting as well. So they have very, very wide range of people on that show. And they manage to use them in very judicious ways. It may be just this one person from the past who you don't quite remember, who's got one great story. And that's it. But the show will accommodate that. And also it's a format which people can subvert. And I think that, again, is probably a characteristic of the comedy panel game, the QuizCom. It's a format that actually the people taking part in it can undermine and get away with it.
I've been told by one of the people on that show that they record for 2 hours because they were contracted for 2 hours. As they come out of that recording, they're punch drunk on having to just come up with stories and laughter. And,
I can believe it.
They say, well, at least we can come out of it and say we've finished something. It's like it's done. One thing I want to say is that it's funny how the panel game has made the jump to new media. There's a service that was called College Humor. It's now called Dropout. They have a show called Dimension 20, which is like a celebrity-led Dungeons & Dragons campaign. One of the other shows is called Game Changer. So what happens is three improvisers or comedians turn up to podiums and they then have to play a game to which they don't know what the rules are. And the rules are different in every show. But effectively, it is a standard panel game where they have fun with giving and taking away points as a driver to entertainment.
Well, I think it probably reflects the fact that, as you and I both noticed, podcasts is just beginning to resemble radio. I'm so tired of new media, which involves comedians without scripts, banging on for hours and hours, hoping for that 6 minutes of gold that they're going to use in their Edinburgh show. But we have to sit through the 6 hours that it takes to get there. So giving people things to do is all to the good. But that's the thing. The panel game is just perfect. Perfect audio and fits within the budgets of YouTube. It's episodic. So, you can listen to it when and where and in whatever order. It is sort of perfect form, really.
And now it's time to return to our chat with Fred Hemmeland, Creative Director of Second Place Studio. Do you have to be extraordinarily careful about, although you might be taking a dramatic image from the content, that image might have other consequences? I remember in the early days of one of our cable providers here, Virgin Media, they did a screenshot from the film Arachnophobia, the one with spiders in it, and it was a shot of a man's face aghast as this massive spider was on the front of his face. And they had so many complaints from parents rang in to say, my child's extraordinarily scared of this spider image, that they had to change it. Are there any sort of blunders like that you can think of?
We have done a fair share of blunders. We haven't done a blunder like that. But it's like we have a good compliance department. And there's always a discussion with legal as well when you're doing something a little bit out there. I think in the UK, obviously, it's a little bit tighter restrictions than in, say, Scandinavia. Some countries like Denmark, very okay to do a lot of things. Sweden, not so much. And then it's actually a good point when you design something, not only for like thumbnail to billboard, but we're in 13 markets, you know, and then you design something that's working in all the markets, then you could go into trouble. Like, we had a comedy, it's actually making a little bit fun of Catholic Church, so that's the content itself, but in some markets, that is not appropriate, for instance. We did have some issues with using the wrong, like using too dark billboards, basically. Actually, the one I mentioned, the stone bust, it's a documentary called Price of Silence. It's a stone bust, and it's on a dark background. But it was going to premiere in fall, and then it was shifted to January. And suddenly, you're working out of home in a very dark time of the year. You only have X amount of sunlight, so no one could see it after 5 o'clock or 4:30. So that was a failure, I'd say. But we learned from these mistakes, and now digital screens, you know, so they're backlit.
Ah, right. So going back to that face with the spider, I guess it's not just the face and the eye contact, but also the emotion that face is conveying. So is it important that when we read the face, we're reading an emotion as well?
Definitely. I think it's you don't even have to see the spider. Like, I've used this example before, Justin, about Midsommar, which is a recent film starring Florence Pugh. And that poster is just her dressed up and wearing a crown of flowers, looking terrified. And we don't see what she's looking at. And there's a similar poster for Jello Jackets when there's a small little bug, right? But not more than that. And it's terrifying. You don't need to show like the big monster in these posters. Just have an actor or actress that can show emotions. That's enough.
So you're trying to summarize the emotion. I mean, to what extent are you trying to summarize the plot?
Well, I think you can't say it all, because then you have to go floating head. And like one of the early posters I remember is like, you know, James Bond movies, you know, and it had all these elements. You have Roger Moore or Sean Connery, and you have all the action and all the, you know, extra characters and the love interest and so forth. And it's like a puzzle. It's saying a lot, and that's awesome. And I love those designs, but you can't do it anymore because it's too busy for a small thumbnail or even an out of home. You pass that like 1.5 seconds. You're not going to stop on unless it tells you to stop and actually print.
The main post on No Time to Die was just Daniel Craig holding a pistol. That was it.
Yeah. It's quite stylized, actually, because it was a concrete wall that they painted with the 007 logo, and he stood in front of that. So they kept like reusing this kind of concrete wall with the color scheme, which was quite a nice campaign. But yeah, no, you didn't need to say more, right? You have a title that's known, and you have an actor that's known for that role, and new Bond movie coming out. That's all you need to say.
So that's interesting, because that brings us on to text, because it isn't always just image, it's image and text as well, and how they fit together. So what are some of the psychological tricks around the use of text?
Well, text, I mean, is almost as important. I wouldn't say it's as important in this case, but you need a title that you can play with or against, and you need something that's super clear. Because if it says something like, if the director gets to decide, maybe it's some abstract line of the copy, and it sounds awesome, but it doesn't say anything. And it doesn't help guide the audience towards which direction you're going, right? It's all about guiding the audience. And I think for us, it's playing with capitals versus lowercase, you know, experimenting with the kerning and the weight, and trying to make it as easy to read as possible. That's usually the trick, which colors not to use on top of other colors. Lowercase is much harder to skim, for instance. Capitals are block-like, so your eyes just scan them and you ignore them.
Oh, right.
That work in lowercase.
So it's more common to have lowercase in key art.
Definitely. And no handwritten fonts.
Oh, right.
Because that's a nightmare to read.
Do you get to choose the fonts, though? Because presumably the sort of style package of the production will dictate a lot of that?
Yeah, it differs from network to network. So we try to use the style guide given to us by a production company. So then it's already pre-decided. So unless it's like completely wrong, then we won't switch it. And by completely wrong, I mean like it's not readable in a small format. Then we will skip it. But some of our competitors, like HBO and Netflix, they don't care. They will do whatever is nicest looking for their campaign. And then,
yeah.
And I think they're not wrong for doing that, because who remembers what the titles is in the program anyway? You remember what it looks like on the campaign. So as long as you use the same logo on all the campaign assets, I think you're fine doing that.
Let's go back to symbols, because I remember you talked about using a symbol within the image that is not maybe an obvious direct reference to something as strong as the ring in Lord of the Rings, but it nevertheless brings people in, and maybe it's the second thing that people notice when they see the image. Could you give us some examples of that?
So we had a show about a woman who owns a gynecology clinic in Norway. It's a drama, and she can't have kids of her own. So you can see the drama right there. She's helping all these other people. And it was red, which interfered with Netflix, clearly. But we had a very strong symbol in a gynecology chair. So she's sitting on that chair in a strong power pose, wearing her actual casual clothes. We tried it with, like, in a doctor's clothes and in a power suit. The doctor became too much of a medical show. It was a drama that was more about life than actually life in the clinic. It was her life outside the clinic that was more important. This is actually a good example of trying different wardrobes, because that's like something we always experiment with as well. And in a power suit and in a power pose on this throne, it was a gynecology chair, but it looks like a throne in this execution.
Yeah.
It became too much. You know, it's like, okay, is it about, like, at first glance, about bankers or powerful lawyers or something? And then when we did her in her casual wear, which was the jeans and a top, she looked a bit more vulnerable, and she's sitting in a power pose but wearing something close that's quite relaxed. And her eye is a little bit fear in the eye. You can't see it until the second glance that she's fearful. Actually, first glance is this is a powerful woman, and that was a nice balance. And the chair itself kind of became a symbol for that campaign, so you will remember that chair like, ah, that's a show about the gynecology, right? So it's kind of helpful to guide the view that way, especially if you buy the right search words on Google, because if you Google gynecology show, you're gonna get some other results.
Do other platforms do what's called A/B testing? So to bring anybody in who doesn't know what that is, so say on YouTube, you can actually supply two different versions of the same thumbnail to YouTube, and the algorithm will work out if one is more popular than the other, and therefore it will then start to favour the more popular version. That happens on YouTube. Do you do that for other platforms?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons you have your own profile, and say you share an account, right? I mean, one is you can share your own list, but for the streamer, it's for them to figure out what you like, right? And then they want to feed you with the similar content. And the same goes for images. You click on an image, they will record that data. And then they will feed you another design that's similar. Because it's all about keeping you on the platform, right? And having you pay the £10 a month or whatever it is for eternity. Netflix does maybe up to 14 designs per series or film. And they vary that depending on your profile and the audience segment. They're trying to achieve and constantly A-B testing. What works, what doesn't.
So that's A-B, C-D, that's up to N testing. That really is quite extreme. I mean, like, YouTube, I think, is thinking about maybe allowing people to do A-B-C. So
yeah.
They've still got a way to go to get up to N.
That is way, 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 way extreme. We at Viaplay don't do that. We have a base layer, and then we have a couple that we vary to see what works. And especially in once again, young adult, that's the hardest segment to capture, see what works for them. And we can do the same test on YouTube and on platform and on social medias and see what works.
Why is it so difficult? Is it because like a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old have different images of things?
Yeah, it's a little bit harder to find them, to be honest. Like, they're now we know they're on TikTok, right? But then how do we engage them on TikTok? That's the big question. The older generation, they're already hooked on TV. They know where to go, and they know that they will fall for the normal print and TV advertisements, and they won't, because they don't read print and they don't watch TV. They just watch YouTube or TikTok.
Do you always get to work with beautiful images, or do you have to do a certain amount of scaling up? So, for example, some of the things I've done elsewhere might involve people on webcams, which might only be like 720p images. And yet I know that that will be something that might have to be on a 4K. So we get to design it to scale these images up. So do you have to do a lot of that image processing?
Sometimes. I mean, there's a couple of different ways of working with these images. If it's a scripted show, then you might work with screen grabs. So that's like lifted frames from the actual shot material, or set photography. I mean, we hire a set photographer to follow around the actors and some key scenes, the very dramatic ones, and we get some photos from that. They're usually quite high res though. And the third option would be custom photo shoots. That's the preferred option, and you get exactly what you want. But sometimes it could be a frame grab, and it wouldn't be 720p, but it might be...
might be suboptimal.
It might be 1.5K, and that's still not enough, to be honest. Yeah. You want to have it beyond 2 to be able to work with it. But if we do have it lower, then yes, you have to bring in a retoucher and start to really rework it up. But it's hard to make it look... Say you want to make it look natural. It's not easy, because you have to polish that, those images. Everyone looks very airbrushed, and that's not a look that's okay anymore. And in fact, it's banned in some countries. Like in Norway, for instance, you have to have a big disclaimer now saying like retouched image, because otherwise they'll take it down. They took down this Kardashian advert, just like the whole campaign went down because they didn't specify that they had a lot of Photoshop done.
I can't believe that the Kardashians use retouching.
I know, I was shocked.
I think they get retouched at a much earlier stage of it all. So talking about stages that you get involved, I mean, that's interesting that you're talking about having somebody on set. What's the earliest that you get involved?
So my team gets involved just after green light. We're in the startup meeting when we have the finances and we have the cast, and now we're going to shoot, and maybe we'll shoot it, I don't know, March. But it's just a heads up saying like, this is happening. And it's actually the first thing that's planned is the key art shoot. So When we get the call saying a new production, greenlit, it's going to shoot, we start looking for dates. When can we come? And then we start looking at what we're trying to say and how we're trying to say it. But first we need that date. And so we're in from day one. We also do trailers for these productions, right? So we stay on until after delivery of the program as well. So it's like a 18 to 3 years time scale here. I mean, it's kind of intense.
I had no idea. Gosh, that's extraordinary. And how much do things change? I remember the original poster, I think, for Race Across the World. And it was people with their backs to us, obviously setting off on a journey. And then the next poster was people facing us, to your point about faces and emotions and all the rest of it. So they obviously dropped that original image after the first go.
It's quite literal, right? You're racing off back against the camera versus like you engage more with someone you can see. Oh, I want to root for that person.
Yeah,
so I understand it. But obviously, if you're creative, then you want to be creative and you want to do something more interesting. And then let's have them race off, you know. It always comes down to who has approval, right?
Right.
So when I have a concept, I have to pitch it to first internal stakeholders, and that could be marketing, PR, content. And then you have the external stakeholders, that's producers, co-producers, co-financiers. You might have a director that has like a creative say as well. We really want to leave them out of it, but sometimes it's impossible. And then an actor might have a producer role as well. And then you have to show them the concept. And it can be quite painful. And Everyone agreed something. We shot it, we put it together, and it still wasn't used. And that's usually comes down to either a star who is suddenly like, I don't like it anymore and have enough star power to kill it. Or A new partnership. For instance, a cinematic release, and that wasn't planned. And then you get in a distributor who's like, doesn't see it the same way, and they want to do something completely different. So it can change completely. But ideally, once everyone align on a look, I really try and force them to stick within those remits. It might change a little bit, but nothing too crazy, because then you have to start over again with the approvals from scratch.
So you've called your new venture Second Place Studio, which seems a very, very counterintuitive name for a creative agency that you'd imagine wanted to be First Place. So what was the thought behind that?
So you don't like the name?
I love it. I'm just wondering why you went for it.
I love these names that are trying to take something negative and turn it into positive. Like, and I think about like Acne, like the fashion brand, right? And that's a very bad name, but they managed to spin around into a lovely fashion brand that sells high premium jeans. But for me, it was something that my dad told me once. We Hammerlands might not always be the brightest, but we make up for it by working harder than anyone else, which is quite harsh, but also true. And me and my siblings work really hard. And then when I was studying art direction, I came across this campaign by the legendary Helmut Krohn. He did a campaign for AV's rental cars. Oh, and he said, right. Like, you know, we're only number two. That's where we have to try harder than Hertz. We're number one, right? And they go an extra mile. And those two kind of pieces clicked for me. So if I ever start a company, it should be second place because we try harder to put you into first, right?
Yeah.
Even if you're in the first place, you can always risk being complacent, right? So you have to work harder because if you stop, someone else is going to overtake you. And that's kind of the zeitgeist of this company.
Avis, we try harder, wasn't it?
Exactly.
That was the tagline, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So Fred, you're going to be joining us a little bit later for your show and tell. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
So it's going to be time for one of our Jargon Buster segments, and I am going to throw something at Justin and see how he reacts, because he doesn't know what I'm going to say next.
Well, probably not.
So buckle up, everybody. So, Justin, have you heard of, or do you know what the word shredditor is?
Shredditor?
Wow. A shredditor.
No, I do not. I've never
heard
that.
So I'll give you a bit of a hint. So okay. It is actually a job title.
Yes, well, I would imagine that it's an edit. Part of it is editor.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other part is shredding.
Well, it's more like the shirt.
Oh, more like so, the shirt. Okay.
So, if you're doing something to do with shirt and it's television,
shooting.
Yeah,
a
that's
shooting
right.
editor.
So, yeah, a shooting producer editor.
All right. This is one of these things you see on the end of a CV of someone who's done 5 minutes on Big Brother.
Well, you're kind of right.
Editor,
yes.
Producer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's. It's also, some people call it a predator, if you're a producer editor. So literally, there are, I mean, it's been known that there's been predators in the television industry for decades.
Well, I
gotta
say,
but, wow. Yeah, so, yeah, so, yeah, this is the thing. I slightly took a gasp of breath when I saw that word, but apparently it is a thing that people say now that they are. I mean, we would probably call them producer directors in the UK, in terms of these are the people that you thrust a medium quality camera in their hands and tell them to go off and film some general vistas for Escape to the Country or something like that. And then.
Yes, or do some background research, but take a camcorder with you or.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you get promoted to running up and down the queue of a talent show,
mm-hmm.
looking for material and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to be fair, these things are legitimate because, as we know, there's not much training in our industry, particularly if you're not coming in directly on the technical side of stuff. And so, you know, the one thing you want to do is to get your hands on a camera and get to shoot something.
So where this is leading me to is...
Where the hell is this?
is, well, at the minute, we're experiencing something of a massive jobs crunch. And I saw a comment from somebody who said that they saw a job advertised that required somebody to be an associate producer, a driver, and a DIT, a digital imaging technician. And they were all part of the same role.
Wow.
And they were appalled by this sort of effectively what was a runner job, a medium production job, and a technical job, all rolled up into one. And I thought, well, yes. But on the other hand, is this where production's going to have to go? For example, don't want to lean too hard on YouTube or similar platforms, but let's suppose that you are a content creator of some kind and you're doing things that are definitely more than a step up from your standard YouTube videos, that they are something that is formatted. I've mentioned Jet Lag the Game several times, that's on Nebula and also goes out on YouTube later. That is run by a handful of people. It's got people that they commission graphics for and music from and have editors and so on. But it's essentially a much, much smaller production than the equivalent would be on television. And the people who are on it are not just the presenters and the people playing the game, but they devise the game, they script it, they voice over it, they promote it, they produce it. They're wearing many, many, many hats. And they're not complaining about, well, you know, you expected me to do X, Y, and Z.
No, and I mean, let's look at what you and I are doing right this minute. You know, we're recording radio. We don't have a producer. We don't have a director. We don't have a script writer. We do our own recording. We're working in a virtual studio. We both edit the show. There's two of us involved in making it. And, you know, and I haven't really thought about that until that point. You know, now, I mean, there are some podcasts which could definitely do with some directing and definitely do with some editing. But the fact is, you know, that it suits the medium. I think it probably is the direction that things are going. The only thing I would say is that I know that one of the ways in which television and platforms like YouTube do not cross over very well is that people who are native to YouTube are so used to being in control and so used to, you know, doing everything that they don't play nicely with others. And therefore, it can become very difficult. I know one instance quite recently where, the plan for taking a YouTube series onto television basically collapsed because the production company and the YouTuber could not work together.
Right.
Because one would not concede control over some aspects of it to the other. Neither was at fault, particularly. They were just coming from two completely different places.
The YouTuber Max Farsh, who does various sort of stunt-led videos. One of the things he did was he wanted to conduct an orchestra. So he found an orchestra that was willing to do this. And he said that they managed in sort of a handful of days with a handful of people to get this done. And yet Rob Beckett and Ramesh Ranganathan did a show like that, one episode of a show. It was part of a Sky series that had 60 people on the production and took about 6 months. You probably could find ways of saying that the Sky show is better, either technically or in content, but the Max Fosh one probably was seen by more people, I'm going to guess, without looking at the figures. And would people notice the difference in quality? Because I think one of the things that we're drifting towards is good enough quality. Things don't necessarily have to be quite as polished as they had to be back in the day. And people seem to put up with a lot more. So, for example, during the pandemic, when everybody started using Zoom calls, well, now if you turn on any 24-hour news channel, Zoom calls are the lingua franca now of how, yeah, how they get both, not just their correspondence on air, but people who want to submit a point.
But that is also a cost-cutting thing. I mean, you're right, it's become acceptable, but it is also about the fact that, you know, news organizations don't have a crew to, you know, send out at a moment's notice to this, that, or the other, or a radio car, or local radio station, or whatever, and those things have gone too. But you're right, and I think it comes down to the fact that because other platforms are content-led rather than, you know, star-led, people are tuning in for the content rather than the quality. I think it's also a little bit about authenticity. If you go back to TFI Friday, for example, which was one of the first occasions when we really saw the you know, Chris Evans would bring the camera direction into the studio, you know, and he would say, camera six, come over here, you know, whatever, and he'd talk down the tube like this and all that kind of stuff. He really showed the workings of a live show, and we all responded to it, you know, as a kind of, oh, right, this is raw, this is authentic, and so on. It's, again, it can still be acceptable now to see the handheld crew in the wide shot of quite a large and sophisticated show, because we're not pretending that they're not there. But there is also an element to that which says this is authentic. You know, you're seeing the thing get made as it gets made.
So if we are writers, hosts, and editors of this show, does that mean we are rosters, something like that. Anyway, see if we can make that as neologism. Anyway, it's a changing time, certainly.
Certainly, yeah.
So we're back with Fred Hemmerland, and we ask everybody to bring something, either real or metaphorical, to show us. So I'm interested to see what you've got for us today.
So I brought a pack of gum.
Okay. I wasn't expecting that. So what's the story behind that?
I say it's a symbol for my first experience in this industry. It's not a metaphor. I wasn't, you know, shoot up and spat out again.
The flavor of it went to after a few bites or something. Yeah.
Exactly. No, it's so I don't know which of my parents had read about there was an advertising shoot happening in Malmo outside where we lived, and they needed extras. And they both knew I was really into this industry and I was trying to get my foot in the door somehow or learn more. So I showed up, and it turned out to be like a Stimroll gum advert, and it was a two-day shoot. The scene was a rock concert where a man and woman lock eyes, they share a gum, and then they share a kiss. And I was going to play one of these concert goers, right? You're a massive audience. You need people to share. But I was more interested in the equipment and the people working there. So I was like snooping around, asking questions. What does the first AED do? How do you measure light? Why do you do it? I must have been a pain in the ass, to be honest. But then we started shooting. And so I'm in the audience, in this fake audience, and a band comes on. There's no band coming on. We have to imagine this, right? Even I had to imagine it back in the day. And they're playing, and we were told it's a favorite band, and you have to go nuts. And, I mean, what does go nuts mean? I mean, I have nut allergies, so it can be quite confusing. But I literally went nuts, and I was shaking my head, so my tongue was out. I looked like I had some kind of medical emergency. And next to me, these people are doing like the normal, you know, they're sharing, they're clapping, they're raising their hands in the air. Like you greet the rock band, not what I was doing. Mm. So the first day wraps, and they started texting people the next day who were going to come back for the next day, right? They're going to text them. And I did not get a text, right? Not so surprising. so I was turned down, but it didn't discourage me from the industry. But I've never chewed gum since.
Oh, right. That's a great story.
But not only was your story about chewing gum, but the brand of chewing gum that you just showed us was called Extra, which I thought was very neat. So,
I mean, it was actually not. They don't sell Stimroll anymore unless you go at the duty free. So I couldn't do the real thing. Failed experience. But, you know, I'm still in this industry.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing that. That was brilliant. And thank you for joining us on TV Show and Tell.
Thank you, guys.
And finally, it's 4-minute format time, where we try and brainstorm a format of some kind in 4 minutes. It does what it says on the tin. Right, Justin, I have 6 words here. Which one would you like to pick?
I will pick 6, please.
Number 6. I have the word envy on my piece of paper. Envy. Envy, E-N-V-Y. So we have 4 minutes to do what we can with that, starting from now.
Well, we've had game shows called Greed and Shafted and...
what are the 7 deadly sins? Yes. It's like, yeah. Maybe we can come up with an 8th deadly sin, like a competition to come up with a new deadly sin.
There's Pride and Prejudice, we've had them. so yeah, so Envy certainly sounds like a money-based quiz show. So it makes me think of Tempting Fortune. So, you know, Tempting Fortune, it's a kind of people on in a reality show, you know, who are making a journey through tough terrain, and along the way there are treats for them, you know, like a cappuccino bar or a spa or something, but it costs them a huge amount of their prize money for it. So it's quite a mean format. Envy sounds like a similar kind of show, except for the fact that maybe you give all the prize money to half the team, and the other team envy it, and it's what will they do? What were they prepared to do to take the money off them?
The thing that it sparked in my mind was I think a lot of property shows are based on envy, aren't they?
That's like, true. Yeah, when it's
you,
property
porn. When you do up a house and you sort of go, oh, why can't my house look like that? I mean, it's partly because they took away about half their possessions, you know, in order yes, to look like that.
It's got no stuff. It's
there's no school bags. There's no cello. There's no bikes in the hallway. There's just where it goes.
Some,
I don't know.
There's just some ceramic fruit.
And one of those sort of noughts and crosses made out of brass on a coffee yeah, table.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. Well, of course, yeah, this is what they do. I mean, increasingly in this country, but particularly in Canada, you know, if you go to a house, you want to buy a house, you go to a viewing, all on the same day, and they literally strip the house. They put the entire contents into a lorry and take it away, and then they redress it like one of those houses.
What if then it could be like you went down your street? I mean, this only works in certain locales but in my street it would work because our houses are pretty similar. You could go down to like five different houses in the street and then you could sort of cherry pick the best elements of it. And then you could try and sort of make your house the best of those five houses that they all feel like envious of what you've done because you've kind of like made the optimal maximal version of what's possible with your plot and your layout of house.
Yeah, I quite like that, yeah. Okay, how about a completely different angle in the closing seconds? So a celebrity interview where they talk about the things about their lives that other people envy about them and what the reality of those things are.
Mm-hmm.
So I envy you your size of your house. And I say, yes, but it takes 30 people to run it and I have to pay all their salaries.
Yes.
You know, I envy your trainers. Yes, but they're so valuable I can't put them on. you know, and so on and so on. So it's a kind of a way into a kind of celebrity interview.
Well, I like that. I think that's probably either a radio or a podcast format. But we didn't say it had to be television.
That's true. That's true. Well, I always think many platforms always go through my head state.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, our time is up. I think that was a strong contender at the end there. So I'm not sure what title we could come up with other than it's just Envy. I think that's actually probably just the title of it. And it's a celebrity-led interview show about what people think their life is like. I think that's good. So that's it for this time. If you want to contact the show, you can tweet us at TV Show Podcast, or you can email us at contact@tvshowandtell.com. Until next time, I've been David Bodicombe.
And I've been Justin Scroggie.
And this has been TV Show and Tell.